Morning, everyone. Welcome once again to Chatham Community Church. My name is Jaime. I'm one of the pastors here. I'm glad to welcome you all here this morning. I want to extend a warm welcome to those of you who are guests, whether it's your first time in a long time, whether you're visiting us from our campus up north of the Haw. If you made that trek and crossed that river, we're so glad you're here with us this morning. If you do happen to be a guest with us this morning, I'd love to say hi to you after the service. So I'm going to be just outside those exit doors. Stop by. And if you're new today or have been new recently to our community and haven't attended what I'm about to share about, I invite you to join us. So every once in a while, we host these things called Starting Points. We host them after services. So we have two services, one now, one just after this one. And between the two services and after the second service, we host a small gathering called Starting Point where folks who are relatively new to our community can come, get to know each other, get to know a few people from long-term members from our community, hear a little bit about our story and what it looks like to be part of Chatham Community Church. So that as you're considering whether Chatham Community Church might be a good church home for you, you have all the information you need. We're going to have Starting Point next week. So next week, both after the first service and after the second service, we're going to have Starting Point. If you're relatively new to our community or have never been to one of our Starting Points, I invite you to join us. You do not need to RSVP. Just show up. Show up, and we'd be glad to connect you with other people. We'd be glad to hear your story, share a little bit more about our story. And particularly, we'd be glad to share what it looks like to be part of our church community. One of the things we talk about at Starting Point is that one of the things that sort of makes people say Chatham Community Church is my home church is when they decide to step into serving in some particular way. There are lots of opportunities to serve, but I'm going to share one right now, right? We already shared Chatham Serves, and I invite you to sign up for that, but we have a need right now that I want to make you aware of. In case you're looking for opportunities to serve, you know that this need is here, and you can step in. Every week, we've got a wonderful team of people who prepare to welcome us. They prepare coffee, they serve out snacks, they greet you with smiles. And those folks would love to have a few more people join them in our hospitality and welcome team. We've got a wonderful crew of leaders there. We've got Michelle and Dion Davis. They are in the back. Go ahead, turn around. You've seen Michelle and Dion Davis, even if you don't know who they are, because it seems like you can't set foot in Chatham Community Church without getting one of their patented smiles and greetings. So they're looking for people to join their team. So if you would love to serve or have an interest in serving with them, go and talk to them after the service. They'd be glad to have you. And we'll talk more about other opportunities to serve at Starting Point next week. Last month, I had surgery on my hands. And it's like a 4 to 6 month recovery process to slowly gain strength and also to take care of some of the sensitivity I still have. So I'm finding more and more things that I can't do and more things that I slowly can do. One of the things that I'm not going to try, but I'm pretty sure I won't be able to do until I'm fully recovered, is play Hungry, Hungry Hippos. Some of you may remember Hungry, Hungry Hippos. Some of you may play it still. Some of you may not be aware of Hungry, Hungry Hippos is. In Hungry, Hungry Hippos, and I'm not going to say that too many times because at some point my tongue is going to get tied, but in Hungry, Hungry Hippos, you've got players at each of the stations behind one of the hippos, and marbles are released into the general area, and then you've got to sort of stomp down with your hand really quickly on the lever on the back of the hippos to extend their mouth to grab marbles. Now, does anyone remember how you win at Hungry, Hungry Hippos? Yes. You don't win when you hit a particular number of marbles. It's not the first 1 to 5, for example. You don't play a number of rounds to see who wins each round and who wins the most rounds. You win at Hungry, Hungry Hippos by having more marbles than anyone else. Now, you could be a great Hungry, Hungry Hippo player. You could consistently get 8 marbles, and you could not win every time. Because enough marbles to win at Hungry, Hungry Hippos is always defined as more than everyone else. Now, that's totally fine and appropriate in a game. It's a competition. It's fun. But it can start to get problematic when that type of mentality, that enough is equal to more than, starts to creep into other areas of our life. When we start to think of being, doing, having enough as having more than someone or more than something. We may think, I am enough when I am more or better than such and such person or when I have more than such and such people. That kind of idea, the enough is equal to more than, that idea pushes us to take. It pushes us to consume. It pushes us to grab for as much as we can, kind of like those hungry, hungry hippos. We try to grab as much as is available to us because we wouldn't want to leave something on the table and then realize that we didn't have enough because someone else had more than us. Haven't many of us asked questions or thought about the concept of enough in that way at some point or another? Maybe not in the area of possessions, but maybe in some other area of our life. We may not have used the word enough. In fact, the word enough may not be so familiar to us, but we may have used the concept of satisfaction or the concept of contentment. But we've grounded it in the place of comparison. We've talked about enough contentment, enough satisfaction, just enough, from the perspective of comparing ourselves with someone or something else. Last week, we talked about how unresolved questions of enough, when we ruminate on them, can easily take us to places of anxiousness, overfunctioning, overcompensating, and hoarding. We can become guarded, even unhealthily so, with everything from our money to our time to our relationships to our love. Sometimes that dynamic is known as having the scarcity mentality. And when the scarcity mentality takes root in our lives, it breeds anxiousness, competition, and fear of loss. A scarcity mentality will often frame enough based on comparison and competition. And that doesn't sound like a very good life because it is an ever-moving target. And so we can never quite reach enough because there is always someone or something that has more that we would want to aspire to have more than. This, my friends, is a trap. Defining enough by comparison and competition out of the scarcity mentality, it's a trap. The bar moves. It never stays the same. And pursuing it out of a place of looking to get satisfaction or looking to get contentment or looking to arrive erodes our soul. And it erodes our relationship. It hurts us. But the good news is that the idea of enough, satisfaction, and contentment isn't actually found in measuring ourselves up against others. It's not found in comparison. Enough, contentment, satisfaction comes from looking to God. And God calls us out of the scarcity mentality. God calls us into an abundant life of enough. In fact, an abundant life of more than enough out of the riches of His grace. Not out of anything that we do, not out of anything that we obtain, but out of the abundant riches of His grace. We're in a series here at Chatham Community Church where we are going to be talking about the abundant life of more than enough that God has made us for and God has called us into. What we saw last week as we kicked off this series was that through the death and resurrection of Jesus, God has done enough. God has made a way for us to step out of the scarcity mentality life and step into the abundant life that we were made for, the life to the fullest, the life that is everlasting. What He has done is enough. It is more than enough. And because He has done enough, more than enough, we get to step in and live in the life of enough, the life of more than enough. Living in that abundance, in that more than enough, changes how we approach every aspect of our life. Not just how we think of our financial resources or our concrete resources, our material resources. It changes how we think about every aspect of our life. And we see some of that in the passage that Colleen read for us from the book of Ruth. So as we turn now to that text, here is the principle that we're going to draw from the story. And I want you to note how different a picture this principle paints. And how different it feels from the picture that the scarcity mentality paints and the life it condemns us to. How it's different from the feelings of anxiousness, of competition, and of fear of loss. God's abundant enough gifts us freedom. It gives us freedom to leave room to bless. And it invites us to trust that provision will come in our time of need. This is very different from the hungry, hungry hippo kind of life. It is very different from the scarcity mentality. That sense of enough, it frees us from the lie that we need to take as much as is available, that we need to consume as much as we can grab, that we need to hoard as much as we can, that we need to use all that is on offer. This guarantees our enough. The passage we read comes from the second chapter of the book of Ruth, and Ruth is one of those books that sometimes is hard to locate in the history of the Old Testament. The history of the Old Testament is a long history. It covers a significant amount of years. So I wouldn't blame you if you're not sure when Ruth is happening. So let me give you some guideposts to sort of locate us in the scriptural story. So if you are familiar with the Exodus, or you are familiar with the story of Moses, or the parting of the Red Sea, that's one guidepost. And if you are familiar or have heard about King David, that is another guidepost. There are, let's say, 400 years in between those two. Ruth is somewhere in there. I know that's a long time, but we're talking about millennia in the Old Testament, so we're okay. We're somewhere in there. It's a time that's known as the time of judges. It is between when people settle into the land and when the monarchy, the time of the monarchy, comes to pass. Naomi and Ruth have just arrived in Bethlehem. Ruth is not from Bethlehem, but Naomi is. It's Naomi's homeland. Her and her family, her husband and her two sons, left Bethlehem about a decade before because there was a famine in the land of Judea. So they go to Moab, and while in Moab, her sons marry. Her sons marry, and one of the wives is Ruth. But soon after, Naomi's husband dies, Naomi's two sons die, and there are no other heirs. There are no other children. And Naomi decides to come back to her homeland. Now, she tries to get her daughters-in-law to stay in Moab, to go back to their family, to sort of try to make a new life for themselves, and one of them does. But Ruth decides to stick with Naomi. She refuses to leave Naomi. She insists on coming back to Judea with Naomi. They are in a difficult situation. This is a society where you needed men, you needed husbands, you needed sons to provide for yourself. Women were very limited in what they could and couldn't do. They've experienced great loss. They don't have means to provide for themselves. On top of that, Ruth is a foreigner. In a land where there's lots of rules and lots of apprehensions towards foreigners. It would be easy in that kind of situation to wallow. It would be easy to lose hope. But Ruth responds differently. She decides, as they arrive in Judea, as they arrive in Bethlehem, with no sense of how things are going to move forward, she decides to go pick up leftover grain in the field. Now, it's possible that she had heard from her husband or heard from Naomi some of the practices of the Jewish people around gleaning and leftovers. We don't know. But what we do know is she's not seen it in practice. She doesn't know if beyond speaking it, people actually do this. She doesn't know if she's going to be safe as she goes into the fields. But she seems to exercise some trust. She seems to have some hope. She seems to have some faith that the God that she's pledged herself to, Naomi's God, is somehow going to provide for them. That God is going to provide in their time of need. That God is going to provide enough. When the scarcity mentality is at work in us and we find ourselves in a place of need, there are two avenues that we can sometimes take. When it seems like we don't have enough, we can sometimes respond by being frozen in despair, and we can sometimes respond with anxious action. But when we live in God's more than enough, we have the opportunity to respond differently. When we live out of the riches of His grace, when we live out of His abundance, we are freed to be present. To be present and take meaningful action out of faith, hope, and trust. Even in times of need. Ruth is there for Naomi. She sticks with Naomi even in her own time of need. Even when she could have abandoned Naomi with permission to go fend for herself and find for herself. But even in her moment of need, Ruth takes a step to care for someone else in need, to be present with and for her, and then steps out to take some meaningful action in faith and hope and trust that God is going to provide. Ruth takes action out of faith, hope, and trust. And the text tells us that it just so happens that as she steps out in that faith and that hope and that trust, she finds herself in the field of Boaz, and Boaz is connected to them through family lines. It just so happens that she lands there. Now, the text frames this a bit tongue-in-cheek. The text frames this in such a way that you know that there's absolutely no coincidence at play, that God is actually orchestrating this to meet Ruth's faith, hope, and trust, her meaningful action with his provision, with his abundance. In fact, the first word that we hear come out of Boaz's mouth is the name of the Lord, the covenant name of the Lord, the promise name of the Lord, the committed name of the Lord, the name that indicates that God is for his people, that God meets their needs. And we hear that name come out in the context of a blessing as he blesses his workers. Right from the beginning, we are being shown that the Lord is going to provide, that the Lord is going to provide abundantly for Ruth and Naomi in their time of need. They will have enough. In fact, they're going to end up having more than enough. By the end of the passage, what we saw at the end of the passage was that she collects an ephah. An ephah is way more than anyone needs to eat in one day. It is an overwhelming abundance of food that will keep them fed for a while now. More than just for that day. He provides beyond. In Boaz, we get a picture of God's more than enough for Naomi and for Ruth. And also we get a picture of what it looks like to live out of God's abundant more than enough. You can see generosity come out of Boaz at every turn. You see Boaz living in the abundance of God through his generosity of blessing. This is a short passage. It's only 17 verses. But in that short passage, Boaz blesses twice. He doesn't speak that many times. But two of the times that he speaks in this passage, he is blessing. The first thing he does is that he blesses his workers. In fact, that's the first thing he does when he sees them. We talked earlier this year during our Change the Atmosphere series about the way that the Lord works through prayers of blessing. When we speak out our good desires over people and for people, when we call forth God's power to be at work in people's lives for good, that's what we said was blessing, that God moves in those to affect people's lives for the better. And we see that in Boaz. He does it twice. He blesses his workers. But then he blesses Ruth as well. He speaks blessing over her. He prays twice in this passage, which is already a lot of prayers for one passage. And neither time does he pray for himself. Now, don't hear that as a condemnation or judging about praying for ourselves. I'm sure Boaz prayed for himself. Please, pray for yourself. Pray for yourself. There's nothing wrong with that. But in this scene, we see him interacting with others. And his immediate response when he encounters others is to long for God to bring about good for them. For long to God to be at work in their lives for goodness. That has to be driven by a deep experience of God's goodness in his life. He has to have experienced enough of God's goodness to feel satisfied, to feel content, to feel free, that when he chooses to speak to God, he can think about the people around him first, especially in their moment of need. He can't help but want God's goodness for others as well. Friends, we can be those kinds of people too. We can be the kinds of people who live out of abundance so that when we see people, so that when praying comes to our minds, praying for others' blessing is right there at the forefront. Wanting them to experience God's abundance is right there at the forefront. And it starts with receiving God's abundant provision ourselves. It starts with experiencing God's more than enough in our own lives. It starts by renouncing the scarcity mentality, by renouncing the pursuit of enough through our own means and receiving God's more than enough through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And we can bless others as well. When we live in that, it can't help but overflow. There is so much that God gives that it can't help but overflow in desires that others might receive as well. Boaz also shows generosity in other ways. He shows generosity with his time. He has time to be present for Ruth. I knew someone who moved away from a major metropolitan area some time ago. They changed jobs, and so they left this big city and went to live somewhere else with a different pace of life. And they had a work colleague, a friend. And as they left, the two of them decided that they were going to keep up the friendship. And, you know, at first when the person moved, it was hard. You know, everything was getting settled, and they sort of left things a few months without chatting and whatever. But as things settled for the person after they moved and the pace of life slowed, they reached out. And when they would reach out to find some time to chat, oftentimes the earliest they could get on the other person's calendar was a month out. A month out. See, this person was living in a major metropolitan area and working in a field where every moment felt like it needed to be occupied. Every second needed to be planned out. The person who moved away thought, you know, if it's this hard to get time with them when we try to plan it, how available will they be for me if I'm in a crisis and really need a friend? The friendship didn't survive. The friendship didn't survive. We view time as a resource. And that's not without reason. Time is a resource. There's some good in that. We can steward our time. We can be intentional about our time. We can apply wisdom to how we exercise our time. But the scarcity mentality can also creep in when it comes to our time. We can hoard our time. We can get anxious about our time. We can try to exercise control over every possible second, and we can become uninterruptible. And when that happens, we live in a place where we fear that others might take of our time. But Boaz does something different. Boaz embodies something different. Boaz is a landowner. Boaz clearly runs some sort of business and some sort of organization. Boaz clearly doesn't spend all his time in the farm. He's got other places to be because he shows up when the work is already happening. Ruth showing up was not on Boaz's agenda. There was not a calendar notification that popped up for Boaz that said, Ruth showing up in 10 minutes. That did not happen. And he could have left it at giving instructions to his employees and making sure that stuff was provided for Ruth. And that would have been fine. But Boaz goes a step beyond. Boaz spends time with Ruth during that day. He chats with her on more than one occasion. He invites her to come sit with him for a meal. He spends time speaking. He spends time listening. He spends time blessing. He takes time to be present with and for her. Now, maybe things got left undone during that day. It doesn't seem to be a problem. Or maybe in living out of God's more than enough, not every second of the day needed to be planned in Boaz's life. Maybe he had open space that was there to provide opportunities to be generous with his time and generous with his presence. The last aspect we're going to talk about, or we're going to highlight about how Boaz lives out of the abundance of God, could be considered the most obvious in the passage. He is generous with his resources. Ruth is able to gather some of the harvest for that day for herself and Naomi from Boaz's field. She gets drinks from the water that Boaz provided for his workers. Boaz shares his meal with Ruth. And Boaz even tells his employees to leave stuff behind, more than what's required, so that Ruth can take even more. So Boaz gives of his profits so that Ruth can have. Who does that kind of stuff? Who does that kind of stuff at someone who shows up unexpectedly? Someone who's living out of a sense of more than enough. Someone who doesn't feel like they have to consume everything that they can gather or have. Someone who has experienced the abundant riches of God's grace. Someone who trusts that when they find themselves in need, God is also going to provide for them. As they are trusting that God is using them to provide for someone else in this moment. Now, something that it's operating in this passage is the principle or the practice of the gleaning. It's a directive of God to God's people that we find in a couple of places in the Old Testament. It is an outworking of God's abundance, and it is a thing that God had put in place to guard against what we would call the scarcity mentality. Here are two places where the practice of gleaning is laid out. One is in Leviticus. It says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyards a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for people who are in need, the poor and foreigner. I am the Lord your God." Now you might think, well, that "I am the Lord your God" feels a little bit out of place there. But here's the thing. God is grounding his instruction of gleaning in something. He is saying that the practice of gleaning is grounded in God's very identity, in who God is. He is saying, "I am God. I am a provider. I am telling you that you can leave stuff behind without fearing that you will not have enough. After all, I gave you the harvest." This instruction here is about their trust in him and his provision, but also their willingness in participating in how he provides for others. He is both inviting them to trust in him and also inviting them to participate in how he provides for others. In other words, they don't take everything out of a trust in his abundance to them and in order that they might have the opportunity to be part of God's abundance for others. Here's the other place where it appears. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, don't go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the works of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. This is why I command you to do this. Here, it's about them no longer being slaves. It's about them being a free people. And it's about learning what kind of attitudes, what kind of practices, what kind of behaviors, what it is like to be a free person after generations of slavery. See, there's no margin in the lives of slaves. There's no margin. Every moment and every effort of every labor is spoken for, and it is spoken for by someone else. It gets taken. As free people, they don't have to live as if every moment and every effort is spoken for and needs to be consumed. One of the ways that they get to embody this is by resisting the practice to consume everything, to take everything, to grab everything. They leave stuff behind. We see this present in the passage, and we see it go above and beyond as well. We get this picture in the story of Ruth and Boaz, of blessing upon blessing upon blessing for this people. And in that, there's an invitation for us as well, because we can embody the gleaning principle even if we're not farmers. Even if you never have an olive branch, even if you don't even know what a sheaf is or sheaf is, you can embody the gleaning principle as well. In many convenience stores or gas stations, you will find this as an option to quench your thirst. You'll find a large can of Arizona tea in some sort of variety with a price tag printed on the can of 99 cents. That price didn't change for so long that people started to get curious. So interviews were conducted, research was done, articles were written. The CEO and founder of the company talked about how they never compromised on the quality of the product. I'm not speaking for the quality of that product, but whatever quality you think that product has, they don't compromise on that. They don't compromise. By the way, I like Arizona tea. I'm not knocking it, but, you know, I respect people's opinions. But wherever they could, they tried to keep costs down. whether it was the amount of material they used for the cans or the amount of budget they'd set out for marketing. They tried to keep costs down so that they wouldn't have to raise the price, even when the market would certainly allow raising the prices without any sort of justification because every other soft drink was raising in prices. They kept the price at 99 cents. The CEO would talk about how he didn't have a say in what people's mortgage prices were going to be. He didn't have a say in what bills were going to cost. He didn't have a say in whether people were going to struggle to pay the bills or struggle to make the payment on the loan. But he did have a say in whether people were going to struggle to be able to get a delicious drink when they were feeling the need for one. And he was going to exercise some agency over that. The company was debt-free, and he felt like he had more than what he needed. He didn't leave stuff on the field. He doesn't leave cans outside of their distribution facility for people to come grab. But what he did leave was profits on the table. He left profits on the table. He could be far more well off than he is, but he's chosen not to, so that other people can have, so that other people can enjoy. He's left stuff at the margins so that he can bless others. You and I can embody that principle as well in our lives. Let me remind us of the principle we're drawing from the passage. God's abundant enough gifts us freedom to leave room in our resources, in our time, in our energies, in our presence, in every area of our lives, room to bless others. And it invites us to trust that provision will come in our time of need. It's an invitation to step away from the scarcity mentality and into, or deeper into, life with the God of more than enough. You have to live in a place of more than enough in order to be willing to do this, in order to be willing to leave space at the margins. And you get there by trusting in God's abundance, by experiencing the freedom that comes when we receive God's more than enough through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Scarcity will tell us to take it all, to consume it all, to use it all, and it will tell us that we need it all. And it will tell us that others can fend for themselves because we're fending for ourselves. And that's a lie. In God's enough, everything produced doesn't need to be consumed. Everything produced doesn't need to be used. In God's enough, with the room we make, with the generosity we practice, we get opportunities to bless others and to embody God's abundant provision in meeting other people's needs. And we get to get caught up in cycles of blessing that we couldn't have imagined. Boaz and Ruth experience this. They are both embodying generosity. There is some immediate blessing here. What the end of the story tells us, what future stories tell us, is that down the line, so first of all, Boaz and Ruth marry. It's an unexpected blessing. But down the line, out of their line, comes King David. And out of their line comes Jesus. It's the cycle of God's abundant blessing of more than enough. More than we could imagine. More than we could ask for. More than we might be able to see. But it becomes possible when we embrace God's more than enough, leave room at the margins, and make space to bless and provide for others. That's the invitation for us today. I'm going to pray for us. My prayer as I pray, what I want you to do is to examine yourself first. Do you need to make a move to trust in God's provision in your time of need? If that's you while I'm praying, communicate that to God. And second, as you think about your life, where are there places where you can start to build in margin? Speak about them to God. Commit to take a step towards that with God, and then be part of God's blessing and abundant provision for others. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you. Lord, I'm so grateful that you've made us for a life where not everything needs to be consumed. God, you freed us from this sense that we've got to produce more because we need to consume more in order to have enough. God, thank you that in the moments when we find ourselves in need, you've provided enough. You provide enough and you bring people around us who provide what we need. Lord, thank you. that you invite us to live out of a sense of already being given more than enough. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for that love. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for the life abundantly for all time. Lord, right now, for those of us in need, would you give us a picture of what your enough looks like and what it will feel as it comes, that we might open our hands and move from striving to receiving. And Lord, show us the places in our lives where you want us to make room, because there's blessing for us to give waiting around the corner. Show us the time, show us the resources, show us the energy, wherever it is. Lord, let's step into, may we step into this abundant, virtuous cycle of generosity, of more than enough. In Jesus' name, amen.